the Ulysses, man's greatest achievement. A ship capable of traveling to distant galaxies, but a freak accident leaves the ship helpless. Its AI, damaged, dangerous, plays a deadly game with the two surviving members of the crew. If they indulge the machine's newfound passion for science fiction and fantasy trivia, it will permit limited access to the astrogation matrix and star drive. For astronauts Clive Ashenden and Rob Wickens, the choice is clear. If they ever want to see Earth again, they must define the A to Z of SFF.
A is for Die and Gamora. Short story, continue.
Well, now this is a heck of a choice. This is an amazing, amazing short story by Samuel R. Delaney.
And the winner of the 1967 Nebula Award for Best Short Story and first appeared in Allison's anthology Dangerous Visions, which is the very first one in 1967.
Now, Dangerous Visions is a real head spinner of an anthology. It's basically Harlan Ellison, who was not a stranger to controversy and pushing the boundaries of science fiction, basically deciding, I'm just going to really push the boat out. So he launched, it was supposed to be three anthologies, Dangerous Visions, Again Dangerous Visions, and The Last Dangerous Visions. I don't think The Last Dangerous Visions ever came out, or if it did, it certainly never came out in the form that Ellison intended. But Again, Dangerous Visions had some of the most extraordinary short stories of the time. And just a remarkable, remarkable piece of work. And to see something like I and Gamora being in there kind of gives you the idea of the tone and the experimentation that was going on in the pages of that anthology.
Yeah, I think the fact that it was the last short story in the Dangerous Visions collection is important as well, because I think you have to give Harlan Ellison credit for being enough of an editor to kind of end on like a final sort of shocking punch to the reader's gut, essentially.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a very, very beautifully put together anthology in its own right. I mean, Ellison does know his editing chops backwards. So to finish off on such a high was obviously a good move, as far as I'm concerned. But the fact is that I and Gamora is an extraordinary piece of very formally constructed but experimental science fiction that kind of deals with gender in a very, very interesting way.
Yes, gender and sexuality.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, at the time it was written, Samuel R. Delaney was gay in a time when it was still a dangerous vision to be that way. And what he was basically trying to do, he said in contemporaneous interviews, was to kind of give an idea of the strangeness of being in that kind of society, and at the same time sort of make it almost much more of a kind of what's the phrase I'm looking for, desired thing to be, I guess.
Yeah, well, the spaces in the story are these kind of almost like angels that sort of sweep into the everyday, grey reality of Earth, aren't they?
Mm. They're kind of a weird cross between, like you say, angels, rock stars, and whatever else, and they kind of, because they're basically coming on leave from whichever sort of job they're doing out in the outer colonies or on the asteroid belt or whatever, they basically just land and just effectively just cause trouble, drink, shag, break things, and then whiz off again. So they're kind of like this perfect storm of crazy love and manic fun.
Well, manic fun certainly, but crazy love. I mean, the interesting thing about them is that they are the sort of differentiating thing for people on the Earth is that they appear androgynous, and they appear, and because of what's been done to them at an early age so that they can go into space, they are sterile and also apparently uninterested in sex.
Yeah.
So, but we find out through the short story, which sort of is, it sort of details this one particular spacer and his various sort of jumps down onto Earth, that there are people that they call, the spacers call Frelks.
Frelks, yeah.
Which is their sort of derogatory slang term for Earthers who have a particular sexual fetish attraction for spacers. For these unattainable, unarousable kind of angel rock star figures.
Yeah, exactly. To the point where they'll quite happily give spacers money for their time, or you know, buy them presents, buy them drinks, food, whatever. So you basically end up with these spacer characters are pretty much kids. Yeah, you don't get any feeling that they're anything more than kind of adolescents, albeit you know, arrested adolescents, who have no real interest in anything. You know, they basically do their jobs, come down to Earth, and just basically look for trouble and a good time. But
they're perfectly willing to prostitute themselves to these Frelks for both extra credits, for money, for presents. And also, one feels, reading the short story, that we're supposed to get just for shits and giggles.
Oh yeah, absolutely. There's this kind of, I mean, they're definitely asexual, but there's almost a feeling that they're kind of shed something of their humanity, or at least you know that what we consider to be humanity, and they've developed something different up there in the stars. So when they come back down to Earth, you almost feel like that it is kind of like an alien invasion of a sort.
Yeah. So you have that sort of, you have that layer to it. And then you have this sort of idea that it's kind of, you know, it's very much subverting expectations of the time, you know, that you have the male prostitute who's desired by the female client, the fact you have a female character who is allowed to you know to have her own sexual desire and agency, which is still at the time is a relatively you know rare thing in fiction generally, not just science fiction.
No, absolutely, and you've also got that element of parody, of course, to the generalized image of the spaceman in fiction up to that point. You know, the fact that you've got, say, you know, moving on from someone like Flash Gordon, Buck Rogers, whatever, through to the sort of Robert Heinlein space soldier kind of a thing. And now all of a sudden we're in 1967 and the spaceman is no such thing. There's no, you know, the spaces are sexless, infantile, is that the right word, but certainly sort of, you know, adolescent, childish to a certain degree, completely selfish, completely uninterested in Earth, really. They treat Earth as a place to go to get some R&R after they've done their work.
Yeah, you also got to think, 1967, the Apollo program is still going, I believe.
Yeah. Oh yeah, absolutely.
So, and at this time, you know, astronauts are portrayed as being the kind of ultimate man's man, as being these kind of, you know, sort of all, you know, these rugged ex-military, ex-test pilots, you know, sort of square-jawed macho heroes.
Yeah, absolutely.
They're risking their lives. You know, this sort of subverts this idea. You know, this idea of the astronaut, the sort of the spaceman, being this sort of this uber macho type, which, you know, was something which is also kind of prevalent certainly a lot of 50s sci-fi. This kind of, you know, Captain Squarejaw coming down onto the planet to colonize it and do right and do away with these pesky aliens.
Well, don't forget, at the same time, you know, 1967, you've got probably the most well-known spaceman of the time, fictionally, would have been Captain James T. Kirk, who was, you know, on the Starship Enterprise, the bad man.
There you go.
So, you know, there's whole notion of the spaceman suddenly becoming this kind of weedy, pale, anarchic, nasty little horrible little thing that people still worship for reasons that do kind of are a little bit beyond me, to be honest with you. I don't see there being anything likeable about the spaces, but, you know.
Well, you've got to think of them as being beautiful.
Yeah.
You know, to look at. The story really harps on the idea that each kind of earthbound person that sort of regards them almost, you know, will sort of, you know, decides, you were clearly a man before you became a spacer, or you're clearly once a woman, you know, and it's interesting that often that seems to be tied into their own preferences there, you know, the sort of subtext here is that just about every Earthman or Earthwoman that they come into contact with these spaces are to a degree either, you know, if they're not actually sexually allured by them, they're absolutely fascinated by them and their difference.
Yeah, definitely. So there's a lot really going on in this story, and again, it's a real kind of, it's a world spanning little piece. It's absolutely fascinating the way it jumps around from continent to continent, much in the way that the spaces themselves would have done. So they've obviously got this furlough period, I don't know, a week or so, where they can just whiz around, but they're able to jump back up into orbit and back down again wherever they feel like it. So you get the sense of there's a slight sense of different societies, different countries treating them slightly differently, but at the same time also constantly sort of lusting after them, I guess, or certainly you know viewing them with an element of awe.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, because I think it does sort of really convey this idea that a lot of the people that they come into contact with can't fathom this idea that they would willingly sacrifice their organs, their sexuality, in the pursuit of this space dream.
Yeah, absolutely. The whole notion that you well, again, it sort of goes back to this idea of kind of, it's almost like the spaces have kind of rejected their own humanity in the pursuit of something else, something other.
It's interesting the way it's, you know, the fact that they've, Delaney is very clear that it's something to do with, you know, he outlines that it's because of space radiation that has this horrible effect on the gametes, I think he puts it, and therefore essentially they have to send geldings out into space, you know, but that being in this case referring to both sexes, so you end up with these androgynous creatures who, you know, essentially become this sort of third sex.
Mm. And of course, that still ties into, you know, discussions that were still being had, but, you know, still continue to be had to a certain extent even today, back in, you know, forward in the 27th century, about gender, about its fluidity, and how it's never quite as cut and dried as we think it is. And I struggle to think of any piece of contemporary fiction of the time that deals with it quite as elegantly as Delaney's Eye and Gomorrah does.
It certainly it felt to me when I was reading it, it felt like one of those kind of landmark taboo breaking stories. The one it reminded me of was not in terms of exact subject matter, but Jose Farmer's 1953 novella The Lovers, which was a story which kind of, you know, basically brought sex into science fiction, I think I'm right in saying.
Correct, yeah. I mean, Philip Jose Farmer was very good at kind of playing around with ideas of sexuality and giving them sort of almost pop science fictional themes in his work. You know, some of the stuff he did, playing around with the Tarzan and Doc Savage characters in some of his books. I think, which again were sort of contemporaneous with Eye and Gomorrah, but yes, so I mean, 53 is very, very early to be playing around with that sort of thing.
Yeah, but I think, you know, the fact that this is, you know, it's a short story written by an openly gay man, and it's you know, exploring all these things. You know, he really that it's, you know, this is the first short story that he sells, Delaney sells, and although he's got, you know, there are various novels that follow on. What's interesting is, you know, I've read a few of his novels, and I didn't know, I wouldn't necessarily have thought, oh, this is obviously a gay author, because he wasn't exploring those themes. Mm. I think you read this and it's very clear.
I mean, Delaney is one of those authors that's just really worth reading pretty much all of his works, just because he is exploring different themes of you know, sexuality and of life lived with a completely different focus. But certainly Eye and Gomorrah is one hell of a star. And, you know, talk about setting up your shop front and just going with it, because he really does it with significant amounts of aplomb and style.
I have one question, Rob.
Go ahead.
And that question is, Eye and Gomorrah, the title itself.
Yeah.
What do you take from that?
Well, apparently it's obviously taken from the Bible, but it's an epigraph on the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah from a speaker who is clearly has great feeling for the destroyed cities of the titles.
Oh, so they are feeling for Sodom and Gomorrah.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, that makes sense, because Sodom in particular obviously was well, very much associated with gay sex.
Party town, fun town. Woo.
Yes. So the fact that you have this gay author kind of subverting that makes sense, I guess.
Once again, Delaney being very, very clever in the way he sort of subverts your expectations in what you're about to read.
Cool.
I think. Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting this self-image that he projects through the story. You know, I mean, does he? He seems to feel equally for the spaces and sort of be sort of critical of them. You know, he's as much in the kind of female Frelk character as he is in the spacer.
Yeah, I think so. But I think he is obviously empathizing with the spacers, but at the same time kind of thinking, well, you know, is this the only way they can live? Is this all they can do? Can they just be this to, you know, to humanity, is this all they are now? So there's an awful lot of questions that are raised by the story about, you know, what the spaces actually are and what they do.
And that's what a good short story does. It gets you thinking long after you've finished it.
Absolutely so. Okay, Psychomedia, what do you reckon? Have we explored Eye of Gamora to your satisfaction?
Eye.
Thanks.
Okay then. Right, quick, let's get out of it before he changes his mind.
Okay. Off to Gamora we go.
Yes. 3, 2, 1, now.
Hammer off.
The A to Z of SFF was written and performed by Rob Wickings and Clive Ashenden. The show was produced and edited by Rob Wickings at All Hallows Post of Reading, the finest sound available anywhere. Would you like to know more? Go to www.theatozofsff.com. Like us on Facebook as The A to Z of SFF, or follow us on Twitter at The A to Z of SFF.